Hello, everyone. My name is Hannah, and you're listening to Mystic and Murder, a paranormal, unexplained, and true crime podcast. On today's episode, we will be discussing the case of the Silent Twins, June and Jennifer Gibbons. Let's start from the beginning. Aubrey and Gloria Gibbons met at Seawell Airport in Barbados, their home country. Both held jobs there. Aubrey was a meteorological assistant and Gloria a switchboard operator. The two began to date and were married on December 8, 1955. In 1956, Gloria gave birth to their firstborn son, Frank. Sadly, Frank died in infancy. In 1957, Gloria gave birth to their first daughter, Greta. 2 years later, in 1959, they had another son named David. Aubrey decided that with his growing family, he would need to find a better job. In 1960, he emigrated to England to join the Royal Air Force. He took the required aptitude tests, and he was accepted into the RAF as an assistant air traffic controller. Similar to any military life, the Gibbons moved around from base to base, going wherever Aubrey was needed. In 1962, he was stationed in Aden, Yemen, when Gloria became pregnant with twins. June and Jennifer Gibbons were born at the Royal Air Force Hospital in Aden on April 11, 1963. June Allison Gibbons arrived first at 8:10 a.m. Just 10 minutes later at 8:20 a.m., Jennifer Lorraine Gibbons was born. Gloria, now a stay-at-home mom to four children, noticed that even at a young age, the twins wanted to do everything at the same time. She even had to breastfeed them at the same time, otherwise one of the twins would become inconsolable. Although June was born first, she was considered to be, quote-unquote, the weaker twin. As they grew, Jennifer hit all of the major milestones first. She sat up, crawled, and walked before June did. Both of the girls were a bit late in everything when it came to their development. Their development was especially noticeable when it came to their speech. By 3 years old, June and Jennifer would just utter two or three word sentences. In 1967, the Gibbons welcomed their fifth and final child, Rosie. At this time, June and Jennifer had already started school, but they still were not speaking. In their first year of school, the teacher reported at the end of the year that June was not well settled at all and seemed to be inseparable from Jennifer. Her independence grew slightly as the year progressed, but not by much. June would cry for long periods of time if she was upset, and she refused to talk to the teacher. She would, however, speak with other children. The following year, the teacher's report stated that June could write a bit, but lacked the confidence to speak or read. It also stated that the twins, quote, tend to be content to do very little. They show little initiative or imagination, end quote. The girls were sent to a weekly speech therapy class in school, but it didn't help. They were instructed to practice sounds and words at home using exercise books, but they wouldn't. When the twins were 8 years old, it was reported that they could read and write fluently, but still would not speak. The report stated that Jennifer, quote, has no oral response, but writes diligently, end quote, and June was, quote, still silent and won't converse, end quote. It was also noted that both twins were very shy. At home, Aubrey and Gloria noticed that the twins would talk endlessly with each other, but they could rarely make out what the girls were saying. You see, June and Jennifer had created a language all their own. Their words were like a secret code that no one else could understand. This strange phenomena is more common than you'd think, and there's actually a name for it. It's called cryptophasia. The word literally means secret speech and is used to explain a secret language developed by twins. Cryptophasia also envelops the mirrored actions that twins will do, like walking exactly the same or having identical mannerisms. It's reported that up to 50% of twins develop this language when they're young, and it's often due to one twin being less developed than the other in terms of language and speech development. Because the twins are growing and developing at the same time, they have the ability to communicate with each other without resorting to proper grammar. This can often lead to an even greater delay in linguistic development in one or both twins. Oftentimes, external factors can contribute to this, such as lack of stimulation or interaction with adult language models. June and Jennifer both attended school, had two older siblings, a younger sibling, and both parents in their lives, so it doesn't seem like the cause of their cryptophagia would be due to lack of an adult language model, but it seems likely that it could have stemmed from delayed development of one or both twins. In 1971, when the twins were 8 years old, Aubrey received new orders. He was to be stationed at the RAF Chivenor base, so the Gibbons family relocated to the village of Braunton, England. The twins didn't do so well with this change. At their new school, they were laughed at, taunted, and bullied. This was in part due to their silence and their strange behavior, but also because the Gibbons were the only colored family in town. This caused the girls to depend on each other even more as they withdrew from the outside world. They completely stopped talking to others, and they even became more isolated from their own family. They would only answer questions with monosyllabic responses. In fact, the girls had never spoken to their older siblings or their father with anything beyond this. Their parents worried about the girls' silence, but they were told by many that it was probably just a phase and the girls would grow out of it. A few years after moving to Braunton, the Gibbons would relocate again when the girls were 11. The whole base was being transferred to Haverford West in West Wales. Before the transfer, some teachers and educationalists visited the base to discuss any concerns that the parents had. Tim Thomas, a child educational psychologist, was one of the guest speakers. Aubrey confided in him, telling him of the girls' issues. Tim told Aubrey that the twins would likely grow out of this in adolescence and should remain in a normal school. Tim felt that the girls would get any necessary treatment at their new school. Though they would be attending school with some of their old classmates, this didn't make anything easier for the girls. They didn't speak to anyone, they were never seen eating or going to the restroom, and they were never seen apart. Most of the time, one girl would be standing in front of the other, and the teacher said that they just seemed to stare straight through you. They continued to be bullied and were accused of quote-unquote dumb insolence by the teachers. The bullying was so bad that the twins were allowed to leave school 5 minutes early each day. The headmaster at the school recalled the first time that he saw the girls leaving. He looked out the window to see the girls walking in a goose-step style. You know, the march where soldiers will swing their legs up completely straight? That's how they were walking. Not only that, but one girl was following behind the other, about 10 yards back. He wanted to see how long the twins would keep this up for, so he actually hopped in his car and followed them throughout the town. Not once did they break their stride. Despite being bullied and being completely silent, the twins did manage to make one friend. Her name was Diane Williams. June, Jennifer, and Diane would go shopping together and walk the town. The girls actually spoke to Diane, who said that the girls seemed quite normal to her. Sure, they spoke a bit funny and they were hard to understand at first, but she got used to it. Diane's mom said that she would hear the girls chatting along, but if she entered the room, they would instantly go silent. Diane said that the girls were not happy and she felt sorry for them. June and Jennifer did not do well in school, socially or academically, but they were well-behaved children. It wasn't until 2 years at this school that the headmaster called a meeting with Gloria and Aubrey to discuss the twins' silence. Gloria defended the girls, who she often referred to as the twinnies. She said that they were just shy, and she gave no inclination that the girls didn't speak at home. Their attitude seemed to be that it didn't matter as long as they were learning. However, things at home were getting worse. June and Jennifer no longer spoke to Aubrey, Greta, or David. They only spoke here and there to Gloria, But they did actively speak and play with their little sister Rosie, as they adored her. The subject of their silence was dropped until the school medical officer, Dr. John Rees, came to the school one day to administer routine tuberculosis vaccinations. All the kids lined up for their shot, including June and Jennifer. It's not mentioned who went first, but one of the girls reached their turn, and Dr. Rees recalls grabbing her arm and looking up, about to make a joke to ease the child, but he said that she was staring straight through him like a zombie, or as if in a trance. This made him feel uneasy. He kept doing his job, and a few children later, the same thing happened again, this time with the other twin. Dr. Rees felt so disturbed by the sensation of their quote-unquote dead arms that he requested two meetings, first with the headmaster, and next with June and Jennifer's parents. Gloria and Aubrey were very cooperative, telling Dr. Rees of the girls' behaviors. They mentioned that they rarely spoke at home and often went straight up to their rooms after school, where they would twitter away in their secret language and play with their dolls. About 6 months prior to Dr. Rees's involvement, Gloria had the girls examined by their general practitioner, who suggested that they may be tongue-tied. This is a physical condition present at birth where the tissue at the bottom of the tongue is too short, too thick, or tight. The condition effectively tethers the tip of the tongue to the base of the mouth, causing difficulty speaking and eating. The twins were unable to stick their tongues out past their lips, which is a telltale sign of this condition. They arranged for surgery to correct it, but hadn't done so yet. Dr. Rees didn't think that the surgery was necessary, as the girls had breastfed with no issues, so he assumed that this was not the cause of their speech problems. Dr. Rees asked permission to refer the girls to a child psychiatrist, Dr. Evan Davies, to which the parents approved. At this point, it was unknown if the girls were even capable of speech, or if they could talk and just chose not to. When they met with Dr. Davies in 1976, the girls started their session with a bit of a charade. They had arrived in large winter coats, and it took them an extremely long time to take them off. This wasn't due to their typical slow movements, but Dr. Davies noticed that the girls refused to move if he was looking at them. He noticed that when he was facing away from them, he would hear the girls shuffling around. Eventually, he just stopped turning around so the girls couldn't play that game. Of course, nothing really came out of this meeting, not from the girls anyways. In their silence, Gloria attempted to answer any and all questions, which barely gave the girls a chance to speak, even if they wanted to. Dr. Davies determined that the twins had elective mutism, which is where a person chooses not to speak, even though they're capable of doing so. It typically occurs after a period of emotional trauma. In today's world, elective mutism is an outdated term. Presently, their condition would probably be referred to as selective mutism, which is a complex childhood anxiety disorder that can persist into adulthood if left untreated. Basically, someone with selective mutism is unable to speak in certain social situations due to their anxiety. They were never diagnosed with this, but in today's terms, this seems closest to elective mutism. Dr. Davies assumed the girls probably had a speech impediment that caused their mutism. Though he had treated cases of elective mutism before, Dr. Davies was reluctant to take on the twins' case. He thought that the twins would likely feed off of each other and be more difficult to treat. He referred the girls to a speech therapist named Anne Treharne. Anne had worked with several cases of mutism before, so he thought she may have a better chance of succeeding. The girls began their speech therapy with Anne in 1977. Anne used a tape recorder method to get the girls to respond. She would ask them a question and then leave them alone in the room with a tape recorder. This way, they could answer the questions without fear of being heard. Using this method, she would still get short, monosyllabic replies from the girls, but she did note that they were eager to read out poems or passages from books on tape. When she played the tapes back, she noticed that June and Jennifer had very thick speech. Their S's sounded like SH. And they also had a bit of a West Indian accent, which makes sense because their main role models, their parents, were from Barbados. Anne also noticed that the behavior between the girls was particularly strange. She said, quote, "I might get a yes or no or thank you out of June. Nothing from Jennifer." There was a sort of game going on. I could see June dying to tell me things and then something would happen. Jennifer was stopping June. She never moved. I watched and I could barely detect the slightest eye movement, but I know that she was stopping June. It was strange, like extrasensory perception. She sat there with an expressionless face, but I felt her power. She made all the decisions. The thought entered my mind that June was possessed by her twin. End quote. A few weeks after starting speech therapy, June and Jennifer both underwent a lingual phrenectomy, or tongue clipping. During this procedure, the tissue under the tongue is cut, allowing it to move more freely. Back then, it was thought that speech impediments could be the result of being tongue-tied, but today, many medical professionals agree that there is really not sufficient evidence to correlate the two. The speech therapist, Anne, said that the girls' speech improved very little after the operation, and the girls seemed to be resentful of the procedure. Now that the school had been alerted and the medical professionals were becoming involved, another big change was underway for June and Jennifer. It was decided that the girls would be transferred to a new school, Eastgate Center for Special Education. Eastgate was just a few miles away in Pembroke. Aubrey and Gloria welcomed this change for the girls, hopeful that it would get them the professional treatment they needed. Dr. Evan Davies' most vivid memory of June and Jennifer is when he went with the girls to visit Eastgate Center to see if they would like it. He remembers them sitting side by side on a sofa, drinking tea. The girls slowly crossed their legs and lifted the teacups to their mouths in perfect synchrony. Dr. Davies believed that neither twin wanted to be the initiator of any movement, which is why they moved so slowly. He also believed that they must have had an intuitive link that enabled them to have such synchronized movements. The girls began attending Eastgate in April of 1977, just 8 days after their 14th birthday. Their new teacher, Kathy Arthur, also reported that the girls did everything in slow, synchronized actions. She realized that the twins would constantly be monitoring each other. They did everything together. Kathy set up activities for the twins to do in attempts to get them to move on their own free will, but they failed. She had them try exercises, like touching their toes. Her thought was that if their heads were down, the girls wouldn't be able to see each other and they would have to move independently, but the girls either refused to do it, or they would move so slowly and just stop halfway that Kathy would have to physically straighten the girls up, otherwise they would just stand there, stuck in that position. She had them try horse riding, which proved that the girls were able to move quickly if needed, but issues still presented themselves. If the trainer voiced any criticism, the girls would immediately withdraw. They would both drop the reins and just sit there. Probably the most bizarre thing about their horse riding lessons is if one girl fell off her horse, the other would immediately fall too. At Eastgate, the girls had an entire team monitoring their progress. The team consisted of the teaching staff, Dr. Davies, Tim Thomas, educational authorities, and social workers. Kathy worked hard with the twins to break their silence, rewarding them with praise and encouragement. She used the tape recorder method to get the girls to speak to her at first, asking them questions and then leaving them alone with the tape recorder to reply. Sometimes she would get a response, but not always. She even brought in a teacher friend of hers, who was West Indian just like the girls, in hopes that this would encourage them to speak. He chatted with the girls, saying, "Am I married? Have I got kids? Come on, ask me something." When they played the tape back, they thought it was silent until the very end, when they heard the girls giggle, and one of them said, "What should we say?" A long pause followed, and the other girl said, "God knows." The team worked to carry out psychological assessments of the girls. Kathy administered the Ben Anthony Family Relationships Test. This test objectively assesses the feelings and emotions a child has towards their family members. Kathy sat each twin down separately to conduct this test. They sat at a table with a row of boxes in front of them. Attached to each box was a cardboard cutout representing a member of the family. There are cards with questions on them, read out by the administrator of the test. The questions were things like, "Who comforts you when you're ill?" Or, "Who likes to hug you?" Or, "To whom do you tell your secrets to?" After reading the question on the card aloud, Kathy would hand June or Jennifer the card, and they would respond by placing it in the appropriate box. In the case that they were unable to answer the question, there was an extra box with a cutout named Mr. Nobody. At the end of the test, the cards in each box were counted. For June, 38 out of 85 cards were put into Mr. Nobody's box. That's 48% of the cards. Jennifer, on the other hand, placed 52 cards into Mr. Nobody's box, which is 62%. This demonstrates that June's relationship with her family was poor, and Jennifer's was even worse. The team knew that the twins barely spoke at home, but they adored their baby sister Rosie and they loved to play with her. Kathy had the idea to set up a camera in a room with a one-way mirror and observe the twins. She wanted to see how they played with each other and if they would play with another younger child like Rosie when they believed they were not being watched. Kathy filmed herself playing with some musical instruments in front of the twins, who just sat there unresponsive. She left the room and sent in a little girl named Allison, who the twins liked. Allison was a very playful little girl, and she immediately grabbed a drumstick and started pounding on the instruments and laughing. You could see the tension release from June and Jennifer's face on camera, and they slowly began to smile and laugh. June also grabbed a drumstick and began playing with the cymbal. Kathy was curious what the return of an adult would do, so she entered the room. Immediately, the body language of the twins changed. They stiffened as the smiles disappeared from their faces, and they just stood there. Kathy used a similar method to hear the twins speak. She wanted to see if she could catch them talking in their secret language. So when they were unaware that anyone could hear them, an audio tape was set up to record their conversation. Kathy thought that it sounded like they were just speaking very rapidly, so she took the tapes and played them back at different speeds. She was right. The twins' secret language was just common English, spoken at an extreme speed. There were subtle changes here and there to the emphasis put on certain syllables, and they did have a little bit of an accent, but it was English. Towards the end of 1977, Kathy and Tim Thomas determined that the girls were making very little progress together. Based on other twin studies, they concluded that it may be best to separate them. Kathy wanted to know June and Jennifer's thoughts on the matter, so she assigned them an essay on separation. Both actually seemed to be in favor of the idea. The essays were written on October 6, 1977. In her essay, June wrote, quote, "People keep telling us to change, to turn over a new leaf, but we're waiting for each other to start first. So if we separate, none of us will know if we change first. If we separate, now the future will be good for the pair of us." End quote. Likewise, Jennifer wrote, quote, "We think it best if we separate. We are both awaiting each other to talk and change. If we separate, we will not know whether any of us had done it first. We both fight for the best things. We are both willing to lead our own lives, but when we are together, we just keep depending on each other too much." End quote. On December 5, 1977, Kathy and Tim held a case conference with the team to discuss the proposal of separating the twins. Also in attendance were two people from the adolescent unit in Carmarthen, which was led by Dr. Davies. Kathy and Tim showed a video of the twins to those in attendance. They presented the twins' essays asking for separation, and they mentioned that this was simply a trial and a quote-unquote first stage separation for the girls. Still, no one was really fond of the idea, and some claimed that it was distasteful and inhumane. The staff from Carmarthen stated that they would take both girls or neither of them. However, the special education executive of Eastgate said that if both girls left, he couldn't ensure that a place would remain for them at Eastgate. It was a big decision to make, especially if the twins couldn't be guaranteed to keep their spot at Eastgate. At first, June and Jennifer were all for their separation, but once it became more of a reality to them, they felt threatened. One night, Tim Thomas was sitting at home when his phone rang. There was a young girl's voice on the line, unfamiliar to Tim, and she said, "Good evening, Mr. Thomas. This is the twins. We would like you to know if you don't separate us, we'll start talking next week." Tim wasn't really sure if this could be one of the twins. If it was, which one was it? He thought it was a prank. He had no idea how the girls would have gotten his number. He called Kathy only to discover that she and other members of the staff at Eastgate had received this same phone call. However, the girls couldn't hold up to their end of the bargain, so the plans for separation continued. Finally, Dr. Davies and his staff agreed to take one twin into the adolescent unit at Carmarthen. Tim sat the girls down and told them the news. One would stay, one would go, and they would get to choose. First, the girls sat there, silent as always. They slowly turned to look at each other, their bodies tense. All of a sudden, Jennifer lunged at June, clawing at her face and drawing blood. June grabbed Jennifer's hair and ripped out chunks of it. They ran out of the room, chasing each other and screaming, and they had to be pried apart by Tim. Afterwards, he said they went limp, like ragdolls. After they received the news, they began their telephone game again, calling around the staff members, promising to talk if they could both stay. However, on March 13, 1978, the twins were separated. Tim and Kathy met at the twins' house, and Tim drove Jennifer to Eastgate while Kathy took June to Carmarthen. Nothing really changed for Jennifer, aside from missing her shadow, but June's life was greatly altered. She would be living in the adolescent unit at Carmarthen. The timing of the separation wasn't at all great because just 4 days after being admitted, June was able to come home for Easter. While she was home, the girls were at it again with the phone calls, trying to end their separation. On April 8th, the day before their birthday, June was admitted to Carmarthen again. The next day was the twins' 15th birthday, and June wouldn't get out of bed. Dr. Davies said that he and one of the other staff members had to physically lift her from the bed, stand her up, and actually prop her body against the wall as if she were a plank. June shared her room with two other girls, and she wrote in her diary about the resentment she had against Jennifer. She was able to go home, lay in her own bed, see their family, and eat their usual foods. June, on the other hand, wrote about her agony having to eat strange food in the presence of strange people. The head teacher at Carmarthen, Vivian Hughes, said that everyone tried to warm up to June, but she always stood alone, isolated from others, just staring ahead. That wasn't even the strangest part. June was always crying. And not regular, vocalized tears with weeping and sobbing, but silent tears. She stood there like a statue, allowing the tears to flow down her face, making no sounds. She never tried to wipe them away. Teachers and even students would carry tissues around, wiping her tears for her, and June didn't acknowledge them at all. The only time June ever seemed like her usual self was at lunchtime when she was allowed to call Jennifer. When the call was over, she would continue grieving. Vivian said, quote, What struck me about her was the strength of will which lay behind her stillness. It seemed she was on a leash to Jennifer. There was something almost mystic about their relationship, like black magic. I felt June could have been a normal, popular girl if she had been released from her sister. End quote. In the following weeks, June began to refuse all food. She seemed severely distressed, so they allowed her a weekend trip home. On Monday, May 8th, June did not return back to Carmarthen, and Jennifer skipped school at Eastgate. This is when it was decided that the separation would end and June would return to Eastgate. The stress that was being put on June just was not worth it. Tim and Kathy felt as if they had failed the twins. In the summer of 1978, Kathy was studying to receive her Bachelor's of Education in Special Education. She chose to study the twins as her research project, and she conducted a 24-week behavior modification program in which she isolated one twin from the other periodically to see if they would begin to behave in a normal way. She chose Jennifer to do this with. Every other Friday, Jennifer would spend the day with her. They would walk through the countryside, go shopping, go to the library, museums, castles, and other fun places, but nothing changed. Jennifer would always walk 20 feet behind Kathy at least, and if Kathy turned around to see if Jennifer was still following her, Jennifer would stop in her tracks. Jennifer showed no interest in any of the places they went and wouldn't look at anything that should have drawn her attention. Kathy tried to teach Jennifer how to prepare a simple meal, but was unsuccessful. Once, she placed a potato and a knife in Jennifer's hands, and Jennifer just allowed them to fall to the floor. The only area of success was borrowing and reading books. Kathy would show Jennifer pictures, encouraging her to write stories about them, and she did. Kathy hoped that the development in writing would increase the twins' communication and decrease their isolation. At the end of the 24 weeks, Kathy retested both twins with the Ben Anthony Family Relationships Test. Sadly, both twins put about 85% of the cards in Mr. Nobody's box, showing that their relationships at home had declined even more so. Although the twins' experiences were different within the last 24 weeks, their personalities had become even more similar. Kathy concluded that her program was limited in effect. After all of this, she decided to leave teaching and start a family. Knowing that the twins' future didn't look bright, she felt guilty and she felt as though she had abandoned them. Left with a new teacher at Eastgate, the twins communicated less and became defiant with the staff. When asked questions via tape recorder, the twins would respond with short, impersonal messages. Their written replies had a harsh tone to them. For instance, June once wrote, quote, "First of all, let's get one thing straight. Nobody knows us really. All these things you say about us are all wrong. Nobody really knows what goes on between us two. We both know that we are individuals. We are not trying to tie one another down either. We do not depend on one another. So all the things that people say about us too, they will have to learn to keep it to themselves. It is best not to tell us what you think. Nobody knows us more than we do. We may be twins, but we are different twins. We are exactly alike in everything that we do, but some people think that one of us is the troublemaker and that she is the boss. Boss indeed. None of us two is the boss or the leader. You may think we are different, but we think the same, and we both agree to what I am writing." End quote. In their last few months at Eastgate, conflict arose between the two. June had begun trying to distinguish herself from Jennifer. As she said, they were individual people. Jennifer, on the other hand, tried to make it seem as if they were one person. She felt inferior to her sister as she was the younger twin with fewer talents. She felt safer if she and June were indistinguishable from one another. The staff spoke of another separation, but this only made things worse between the two. This caused the staff to rethink the separation, and they let them both remain at Eastgate. This is when they met Lance Kennedy, an American boy at school. He was 16 years old, tall, and blonde. He had a criminal past, had been expelled from several schools, had been caught high in the school's storeroom, and liked to bait the police. The twins became obsessed with Lance. They never spoke to him, but they would leave him messages as if from a secret admirer. Their obsession with Lance eventually led to their life of crime. We'll get into all that shortly, right after this message from our sponsor. In 1979, the girls left Eastgate at 16 years old. The instructors felt like the twins were not improving and wouldn't benefit from any more schooling. The head of Eastgate sent Aubrey and Gloria a letter explaining how to set the twins up for unemployment. In the fall of 1979, the girls decided that they wanted to continue their education and work on self-improvement. They used mail orders to do this. Both girls wanted to become writers. They thought that if they could become best-selling authors, their family would have a reason to be proud of them. They responded to an advertisement for the writing school. They didn't have enough money between them to both take the course, but they managed to negotiate with the school, by letter, of course. They got the course at a discounted price and shared it. Jointly, they were student 8201. Although the girls were striving for self-improvement, they were becoming even more ostracized from their family. They spent all day in their room, often playing with their dolls. They didn't even come down for dinner anymore. Gloria brought their food up to their room every day. If they wanted to watch television, they would write a note saying what they wanted to watch, at what time, and would request that the living room door be left open so that they could watch the show from the safety of the stairs. They would have Gloria bring up their mail every day, and they would write her notes requesting postal orders, stamps, and padded envelopes. One day, Gloria was about to take a package that the girls had ordered up to their room, but curiosity got the better of her. She wanted to see what her girls were up to, so she decided to open the package. Her heart broke as she read the title, The Art of Conversation. The girls were trying. This book covered things like how to be friendly and how to make small talk, saying things like, nice day, isn't it? Or asking about the weather. The girls longed for a relationship with their family members. They wanted so badly to be normal, to leave the house, and have a family of their own someday. Sometimes the twins' efforts didn't go unnoticed. In 1979, the twins attempted to celebrate the wedding anniversary of Aubrey and Gloria. On December 7th, the twins walked up to their parents' door holding a breakfast tray. It had two cups of tea, one partially burnt omelet, a small crystal vase with one red rose, and an anniversary card. They knocked on the door. Aubrey and Gloria recalled that the twins entered the room, didn't speak or smile, but simply placed the tray on the dresser and left the room. At Christmas time, the twins ordered presents for everyone in their family. This year, they decided that they would abandon their usual ways and spend time with family. They opened their presents in the living room and ate with their family. This was a major breakthrough for the twins. Gloria wondered if they were finally starting to live a normal life, and Jennifer wrote about it in her diary. She said, "At last we have made it to sit in the living room after 2 years. May continue to. It's a miracle that we survived Christmas Day after all. Everything went pretty well." Despite that journal entry, this was the last time that the twins spent with their family as a whole. At the time, Rosie shared the room with them, and she too would play with June and Jennifer. The girls' play wasn't so typical. They created entire towns out of doll families. They would throw parties for their dolls, educate them, have them attend church. The doll families were generational, and they even kept a registrar of the dolls' life events. Their birthdays, marriages, and death dates. They had a doll hospital, with June being the doctor and Jennifer and Rosie were nurses. Many of the dolls died in their fictional hospital. They would write scripts for playing with the dolls and act them out. June described how she and Jennifer, quote, put our whole lives in for the happiness of those dolls. End quote. At the start of 1980, the dolls had begun to lose their significance. Rosie had decided that she wanted to move out into her own room, which caused a rift between the three. June wrote in her diary that she and Jennifer were failing to communicate with their little sister. Eventually, they stopped talking to Rosie entirely and banned her from their room. Sometimes they still played with the dolls, but they'd now use the dolls as the main characters in their stories. Their course from the writing school had begun. Jennifer focused intently on it, doing all of the work, while June was less diligent. When it came to their education, Jennifer had a certificate of secondary education for English at a fourth grade level. June's certificate was for a second grade level. These were the only certificates that they had from their 11 years of schooling. Their self-taught education was much different. With the new course, both girls learned how to write a proper story. They taught themselves grammar and punctuation by reading a copy of the shorter Oxford English Dictionary that they had mail ordered. They studied the thesaurus and analyzed books to improve their vocabulary. Greta had a typewriter that she had allowed them to borrow. Now, the only noises that were coming from the girls' room were the click-clacking of their typewriter keys. In fact, the girls stopped coming downstairs entirely at this point if anyone else was home. When the house was empty, they'd go downstairs, make sandwiches, and fill up flasks of coffee. They stayed up into the late hours of the night, typing away. Most stories they wrote about took place in America. They had always been obsessed with America. They watched American TV shows and paid for a Linguaphone course where they could learn the American dialect over the telephone. Aiming to be the best authors they could be, the girls took a course called Blueprint No. 5, The Essential Fiction Know-How. It discussed how to write popular publications and what not to write about, like addictions, mental illnesses, misbehaving teenagers, widows, funerals, pretty much anything that was taboo in the 70s. Perhaps they took this as a challenge or as an act of rebellion, but they did the exact opposite. June broke all the rules with her first book, Pepsi Cola Addict. The main character, Preston Wilde King, is a 14-year-old boy. He lives with his widowed mother and his sister Erica in Malibu, Florida. He's in love with a girl named Peggy, and he is quite literally addicted to Pepsi, drinking 300 cans per day. His addiction was so bad, it caused Peggy to break up with him. He's a bit of a loner, but he's got a best friend named Ryan, who is actually in love with him and wants a relationship. He often skips school, so his teacher, Mrs. Rosenberg, offers to help him with math, and manages to seduce him while doing so. Later on, he and his buddies robbed a store, Preston drank all the Pepsi, and got caught mid-crime. He's sent to prison, where he receives unwanted sexual advances from a prison guard. Another prisoner sees this and stabs the guard in front of him, and Preston almost catches the blame. He gets released, but his life has no direction. Several more unfortunate things happen, including a lot of death, but he's still in love with Peggy, who's relocating to San Francisco. Devastated, Preston takes a handful of barbiturates, washed down with Pepsi, and collapses on the floor, just as Peggy calls to tell him that they're not moving after all. June saw an ad in the paper for a publishing firm called New Horizon, and she sent her manuscript out. The firm accepted, but they wanted £980 to publish her book. June wrote them a letter asking if they would be willing to publish the book and take the £980 out of the book sales. She even said if her sales didn't cover it, she would, quote, gladly be arrested, unquote. New Horizon didn't go for this, but they came to an agreement of £80 per month, which was June and Jennifer's unemployment money combined. Finally, a dream come true. June became a published author. Jennifer followed suit, writing about things that were taboo. First, she wrote a book called The Pugilist. It was about a surgeon named John Pallenberg and his wife, Michelle, who had already lost two children due to heart disease. Their baby, Lance, a familiar name, is diagnosed with the same condition and only given weeks to live. This story is full of voodoo and supernatural vibes because the surgeon decides that the only way for his child to live is to kill the family dog, a boxer named Bobby. In their kitchen at home, John conducts a heart transplant with Michelle as his assistant, and Lance lives. The parents manage to keep it a secret despite some weird side effects like an occasional bark from Lance or his preferences for meat over baby food. He grows up and decides to build a career as a boxer. He becomes a world champion, but his heart begins to fail. Doctors beg him to end his career, but he continues to fight for the world title and names himself the Pugilist. He wins the championship, but he has a heart attack immediately after. He's rushed to the hospital, where they discover that he has a dog's heart. Lance marries his pregnant girlfriend from the hospital bed and dies. Later, when Dr. Pallenberg was leaving the hospital, reporters surrounded him, blurting out their question when suddenly he feels the sharp pain of a knife. The book ends with him falling to the ground, clutching his wound, and passing out as he hears footsteps running toward him. Jennifer submitted her manuscript to a couple publishers, but had no luck. Next, she would write a book called Discomania. It's set in the year 1983, which was 3 years in the future at the time she wrote it. It's about a world where parents have no influence, school is a place for riots and murder, and the local disco captivates and penetrates the minds of youth, causing them to react with violence. It focuses on a group of American teens and involves drugs, car theft, and death. This book was also never published. The girls loved writing fictional stories, but they took up journaling as well. Gloria had gifted them each with a large leather-bound diary for Christmas. In them, they wrote about their thoughts and desires, wondering what it would be like to live normal lives, to be individuals. They wondered if they would ever leave the confines of their room. They even wrote about each other's deaths as both a tragedy and a release. They wouldn't know how to live without each other, but they couldn't see another solution. When the girls weren't working on their novels or writing in their journals, they were trying to figure out how to be individuals and how to get noticed. At 17 and a half, the girls began walking around town. Oddly enough, they brought a pair of binoculars with them so that they could spy on others, looking into other homes on the RAF estate. Sometimes they'd wait until night and then play ding-dong ditch, running away and then peering into the houses from afar. They'd look for cute boys and follow them around. They also became captivated with cults and witchcraft and attempted to use spells to make friends and draw boys in. Witchcraft didn't seem to work, so the girls decided to look for love and friendship by mail. The girls each put their name into several pen pal magazines and devoted hours to reading the descriptions of the men, wondering which ones they should choose to be their potential suitors. Even then, the twins were growing bored. Remember the obsession with the American boy, Lance Kennedy? They were determined to find his phone number and address. Mr. Kennedy was in the U.S. Navy. They knew that much. So, they called the Navy base persistently. Whichever girl was on the line claimed that they were an old friend of Lance named Lisa Ford. She claimed that she knew him from their time posted in Hawaii. Eventually, one of the switchboard operators believed their story and gave them the Kennedys' phone number. No luck with the address, though. They started bombarding the Kennedys with phone calls. When someone answered, they would go into a fit of giggles and hang up. Eventually, they managed to strike up a conversation with one of the four Kennedy boys named Wayne. Again, they claimed to be Lisa Ford looking for Lance. They learned that Lance had gone back to the U.S. to join the Navy. Wayne wasn't familiar with anyone named Lisa, but he wasn't too concerned about it. He flirted with the girl, suggesting that she come up and see if one of the brothers would do instead. They asked Wayne where he lived, and he wouldn't give an exact address, but mentioned it was by the French Motel, and she, meaning Lisa, should meet him there for a drink. Silence. The girls hung up. On their 18th birthday, the twins decided to venture out. They called a taxi to pick them up at 10 a.m. and mentioned on the phone that they wanted to go somewhere near Fishguard. The French Motel was somewhere along the way. Once they caught sight of the motel, they pointed and tapped on the taxi driver's shoulder to get him to stop. The French Motel was a seedy place. There were a few motorcycles in the parking lot. Beer cans, cigarettes, and other debris were littered on the ground, having fallen out of the overflowing bins. It was also pretty well known for being raided by the police. The girls had not told Wayne that they were coming. They were just there to scope it out and see if they could find any clues about the Kennedys' house. They started going through the garbage, picking up bits of paper and reading them. The building manager came out and yelled at them, thinking that the snooping pair may have been planted by the police. They quickly left. They were intent on finding the Kennedys' house that day, even though it began to pour. They found several houses nearby, but none of them looked, quote-unquote, American enough. They made their way to a phone booth and tried to call Wayne, but no one picked up. Instead of a birthday cake, the girls each got a Mars bar from the corner store. They found a park and sat on the swings, eating their candy in the rain. They had used all of their money on the taxi there, so they tried to hitch a ride home, but no one stopped. Their only option was to walk the 10 miles home. On the way, they found another phone booth. Again, they tried calling Wayne, but no luck. Tired and cold, the girls fell asleep on the concrete floor of the phone booth. The twins were persistent, and they kept calling the Kennedys' house. 1 week later, they were successful in learning the address. They lived in Welsh Hook, which was on the way to Fishguard. On April 21st, they made their way to the Kennedys' house, uninvited. When the twins arrived, instead of ringing the doorbell, they went around to the back and peered into the windows. No one was home. They went back around to the front door, and it was unlocked. They let themselves in and walked all around the house. They snooped around, looking through all the rooms. Upstairs, they rummaged through the boys' bedrooms. The door to one room was jammed, so they grabbed a chair and shoved it under the door handle, chipping the paint on the door and breaking a leg of the chair in the process. But the door opened. They looked through the room, searching for letters, photos, books, or mementos. They tried on the boys' shirts and jackets. They found a photo of Lance and stole it, along with one of his shirts. When the twins were done rifling through the Kennedys' things, they went into the kitchen, made themselves some peanut butter sandwiches, poured themselves a glass of orange juice, and then went to the living room and sat down to watch TV. Suddenly, they heard a car coming up the driveway, so they ran to the back of the house, spilling their orange juice along the way. They crawled out of the back window, but not before Mr. Kennedy saw them. He chased them down the drive, caught up to them, and instead of calling the police, he invited them inside. He started to question the girls, asking them where they came from and if they were the ones who had been calling the house. Of course, they offered no reply. Apparently, the Kennedys were familiar with the local police because their boys were also troublesome. Unable to get answers out of the twins, Mr. Kennedy called them a taxi home. He told them not to come back as the family was out of town for the week, and only one of the brothers, Jerry, would be home. They didn't listen. They took a taxi back to Welsh Hook the next day, only to find the front door locked. They did manage to get into the house through an unlocked window, though. 2 days after that, they rode up again. No one was home, and everything was locked. They decided to break in by throwing a rock through one of the windows. Again, they made themselves at home and went through the boys' things. They continued to make trips to the house, and on one occasion, Jerry was home and invited them in, but they ran off. The twins spent most of their time now hanging around the town of Welsh Hook. They watched other teenagers hanging out, but never attempted to join. They hung out on the street corners, mainly looking for Wayne or Jerry. On May 30th, 1981, June wrote about a special occasion in her diary. The girls had been speaking to Wayne and Jerry over the phone. No one from their family was home that day, so they invited the boys over at 7:30 p.m. 7:30 came and went, and she thought that they had ditched them, but she heard loud knocks on the door at 10:30 p.m. They hung out in the living room, watched a movie, and went home. The next day, the boys invited June and Jennifer to hang out with them at the local arcade. They agreed to meet up later that night as well, and Wayne and Jerry had promised to sell the girls some marijuana. So, they went to Welsh Hook with two bottles of vodka in hand, and they met up with Wayne at his house. June, Jennifer, and Wayne then made their way to a popular teenage hangout spot in Welsh Hook, which was under the bridge. Two other girls were there already, and Jerry joined them shortly after with some paint thinner and tissues. They taught June and Jennifer how to get high, which was a feeling that they would come to depend on. When they were drunk, or high, the girls felt a release. They were actually able to talk and have fun. That summer, they would become obsessed with sex, drugs, and alcohol. The twins became regulars in Welsh Hook, showing up nearly every day to visit the Kennedys. They would hang out with Wayne, Jerry, and the youngest brother, Carl. June later said, quote, "We fell in love with them, all of them. They were all American boys," end quote. Eventually, Wayne and Jerry stopped hanging out with the girls as much. The girls continued to show up every day, uninvited. Eventually, Mr. Kennedy told them that they needed to stop coming by, but they didn't listen. One night, Carl, June, and Jennifer broke into the nearby church. I won't go into the details, but that night, Jennifer lost her virginity to Carl in the church, and yes, June was still present. The twins already had a love-hate relationship, but this made things so much worse. Carl had chosen Jennifer over June that night. Jennifer, the younger twin, had now surpassed her sister in life experience. 2 days later, the girls were lying in their bunk beds at home. A song came on the radio that June didn't want to hear because it reminded her of the Kennedy boys. She went to turn the volume down, and Jennifer jumped off the top bunk, grabbing the wire to the radio and twisting it around June's neck, attempting to strangle her. June managed to scream, and Jennifer released the cord. The two sat there crying and drinking, and then they decided to go for a walk. They walked alongside the river, but June was still angry at Jennifer, and Jennifer was provoking her. June pushed Jennifer into the river and held her head down for a few moments, trying to drown her. Suddenly, a car passed over a nearby bridge, and the headlights brought June out of it. She released her sister and dragged her out of the river. June wrote in her diary, quote, "Something like magic is happening. I'm seeing Jennifer for the first time like she is seeing me. I think she is slow, cold, has no respect, and talks too much. But she thinks I am the same. We are both holding each other back. She does not want jealousy or envy or fear from me. She wants us to be equal. There is a murderous gleam in her eye. Dear Lord, I am scared of her. She is not normal. She is having a nervous breakdown. Someone is driving her insane. It is me." End quote. About a week later, Carl and Wayne invited the girls to hang out again. They hung out in a nearby barn, and this time, June lost her virginity. Also, to Carl, and yeah, Jennifer was there. Later that summer, the girls were told that the boys were moving back to America on July 7th, and their summer romance came to an end. Obsessed with their new lifestyle, the girls were determined to find more men. Back on their home estate, they built a grass den in a park that they made out of hay. They would follow boys around and try to lure them into the den. They liked to consider themselves the estate prostitutes, and they'd often share partners. They made a few friends, but eventually, the other teens caught on to the twins' strange behavior and began avoiding them. Bored, they started going around and borrowing people's bikes from their lawns. On September 12, 1981, they took their crimes a bit further and broke into Portfield Adult Training School by smashing a window. Inside, they watched a movie and stole a few magazines. A few weeks later, on October 3rd, they broke in again. This time they stole a radio, boots, doll clothes, and more magazines. They had some coffee while they were there, too. June wrote about it in her diary, saying, quote, "My nature has turned to crime. I am a labeled thief. But haven't I always been one?" End quote. They broke in again the next day, stealing a book, some Play-Doh, and more small things. Jennifer wrote in her diary that she loved being a burglar and that it would be all over the local paper. She wrote about her new ambitions of becoming a perfect thief. They began to vandalize schools and phone boxes. They knocked over motorcycles and stole things from unlocked cars. They smashed the windows of local grocers. They called up police from phone booths, confessing to their crimes and taunting them before hanging up. They called the fire department and ambulances,
911, what's your emergency?
Sending them to addresses where no emergency was present. They broke into a different school, stealing junk food and snacks. But the twins were getting bored of these crimes, and unfortunately, they had bigger plans. June wrote about making petrol bombs in her diary, along with a statement, "I'm going to be the biggest arsonist around." On October 20th, after breaking into the school, they called the police from a phone box. June used her best impression of a deep male voice to confess to the crime, but police kept her on the phone long enough that they were able to trace the call. At one point, she even told them that she wouldn't mind going to prison. Police showed up while June was still on the line. The same night, the twins had plans to set Portfield School on fire. June managed to drop the petrol bomb without police seeing it before they were taken to the station and fingerprinted. While at the station, police questioned the girls for 45 minutes but received only giggles in return. One of the officers called the sergeant asking him what to do. The sergeant was familiar with the girls because his wife was a teacher at their school. He told the officer that there was nothing they could do. Gloria was called to pick them up, and they all walked home. Not knowing fully what the twins had been up to, she reprimanded them for this one crime. The twins were charged with the misuse of an emergency line, and life continued. Just 3 days later, the twins broke into the tennis courts, sprayed starter fuel all over, and lit a match. June wrote about her guilt in her diary, but she also wrote about the excitement of it all. The next day, on October 24th, they broke into a tractor store, stealing office supplies and a doll before pouring gasoline all around the store and lighting a match. A passerby was walking down the street when they heard the showroom windows burst and saw the building engulfed in flames. They called the fire department, who was there within minutes. At first, June and Jennifer were hiding in a phone booth, but soon they joined the crowd and watched the building burn as firefighters attempted to save it. June wrote in her diary, quote, "All the while, my lovely, glorious fire was licking its way through the roof, and the thick smoke filled the night sky. It was a picture which will live in my mind forever." End quote. The night seemed to go as planned for June and Jennifer, but the neighbors had actually seen them breaking into the store and reported them to the police. The next morning, police showed up to their house to question them. Of course, the girls didn't say anything, but shook their heads. The police left. Jennifer wrote in her diary, quote, "I feel like an escaped convict. I'd like to go to jail. I know I will soon. My passion for crime is overpowering my inner self." End quote. You see, when they were in their midst of their self-improvement and witchcraft phase, they had purchased a dream interpretation book. The twins saw the police as protection and someone who could help them. They viewed prison as a place of security. Because of this, the girls actually wanted to go. The next week, the local paper came out and the tractor store fire had made the front page. The girls' actions had inflicted over 100,000 pounds of damage. Two tractors had been destroyed in the fire, and one fireman had to get treatment at the hospital because he had injured himself breaking glass to get into the building. The twins were overcome with delight that their crime had made the front page, and the police were now looking for an arsonist. Over the next few days, the twins had broken into two different buildings. Again, the girls wrote about it in their diaries. On November 8th, the girls were out on the town, heading to Pembroke Technical College. Police had been stationed throughout the town due to all of the recent break-ins and arson. On their way there, they noticed a policeman walking up and down the road a few hundred yards down the street, but they smashed the window to the college anyways. The policeman heard the noise and ran down the road just in time to see two figures illuminated by a lit match, throwing items into a bag. Backup arrived and intervened just as the twins began to spread gasoline and starter fluid. The twins were caught red-handed. As I mentioned before, the sergeant was familiar with the twins, so he conducted the interrogation with pen and paper. He'd write down a question and leave the room, allowing the girls time to answer. They wrote down their names, age, and address, but the only admission they gave was for the break-in that night. The sergeant then went to their house with a search warrant and asked to see the twins' room. There, he found several of the stolen goods, and more importantly, their diaries. He now had a full confession. The twins were held without bail. The following day, June and Jennifer's names made the headlines. They were taken into custody at Puckle Church Prison, a female remand center. On admission, they had to be physically forced into the bath because they were just standing there, not moving. Puckle Church was not the safe haven that they imagined it would be. It was very noisy, and all the other inmates scared them. They were escorted into their cell, which was actually a small room with bunk beds, and a pot behind the door, which served as a toilet. The girls were locked in, and they just stood there, clutching onto the pillowcases that held their only belongings: bedsheets, towels, a nightgown, and slippers. Hours later, when staff came in to check on them, they were still standing in the same position, clutching the pillowcases. Neither one of them had wanted to make the first move. The staff had to take out the sheets, make their beds for them, physically lay the girls in bed, and literally shut their eyes for them as the girls were frozen like statues. At Puckle Church, the girls were supposed to serve themselves their own food, but June and Jennifer wouldn't. As much as they wanted to be individual, normal people, they had always had a fear of being noticed and a fear of eating in front of others. The staff placed food in front of them, and they still wouldn't eat. After a few days, they were sent to the prison hospital, where it was determined that the twins suffered from anorexia and bulimia nervosa. They would go through phases of starving themselves, only to binge and purge later on. In the hospital wing, June and Jennifer would alternate who would get to eat. One twin would eat both of their meals, while the other fasted. Both twins lost weight because of this, and sometimes the girls would physically fight over the food. The hospital staff determined their best course of action was to separate the twins, starting in December of 1981. June was moved back to the assessment unit, and Jennifer stayed in the hospital unit. The staff at Puckle Church thought that the girls were completely mute until one day, June's lawyer showed up. June and Jennifer had different lawyers due to a possible conflict of interest between the girls. June's lawyer was Michael Jones, and Jennifer's was Ivor Reese. Both of them worked at different firms. When June's lawyer arrived, both June and Jennifer went to talk to him, as June insisted that Jennifer was present for the visit. The girls were too anxious to meet with Michael face-to-face, so instead, they were allowed to speak over the phone. The staff was shocked to hear how well the girls could talk, and they began to feel duped. As time went on, the twins' resistance to authority grew. The girls were separated, put back together, put in different units, put in different cells. Nothing worked. The guards noticed that June and Jennifer's every move was synchronized. They wanted to see if this was a charade, so they began taking special notice of the two. Even when the girls were separated, with no way to see each other or communicate, they would be doing the exact same thing at the same time in different places. The guards would report to each other and found that if one was reading, so was the other. If one was writing, so was the other. They'd be sitting or standing in the exact same position. One guard said, quote, "There seemed to be something spooky about the sisters, as though they were one mind split into two bodies. It was something better left alone." End quote. The girls were creative. They used exercise books in place of diaries. Their entry showed a growing rage against one another and their situation. One officer noted, quote, "Most of the time they ignored each other, and then suddenly they would fly at each other." End quote. In the diaries, they spoke about their communication issues and the frustration they felt from trying to make others understand them. Both of them thought it was just much easier to mime their needs or to write out notes to express what they wanted to say. June and Jennifer's diaries talk about all the same events, simply from a different point of view. Their diaries were extremely personal and detailed. More now than ever did the twins write about the hate they held for each other. In one entry, June refers to Jennifer as the creature who lounges in her cell with her every hour of her living soul. She goes on to write, quote, "We have become fatal enemies in each other's eyes. We feel the irritating deadly rays come out of our bodies, stinging each other's skin. We scheme, we plot, and who will win? A war which has gone on much too long. When will it reach the climax? Tonight? Tomorrow? Sunday? A deadly day is getting closer each minute, coming to a point of imminent death, like my hands creeping out against the night sky. Intentions of evil, blood, a knife, a mincer. I say to myself, how can I get rid of my own shadow? Impossible or not impossible? Without my shadow, would I die? Without my shadow, would I gain life? Increase my situation or decrease it? Be free or left to die? Feel weak or sometimes powerful, without my shadow, which I identify with the face of misery, deception, murder." End quote. Another entry read, quote, "My mood, her mood, clash, like spilled blood. My perception, her perception. Twisting and clashing, knowing, cunning, sly. And where will it all end? In death? In separation? I cannot help it. She cannot help it. It comes over us like a vague mist. It sends murder into my heart, rage into my head, this early morning anger." End quote. In the same entry, June talks about the torture that stems from their childhood rituals. She spoke of wanting to get out of bed, but feeling paralyzed by Jennifer's stillness. Who would be the first to move? She wrote, quote, "Time to unlock. The officers are here, opening each door. I wait, tense, like a cat ready to spring, but not springing. Without a sound, using the hustle and bustle to drown out the slipping of my body from the sheets, I touched the ground. Then she is moving, angry, raging. For who has won the war? Not I, really. I still feel rage in my soul. But if she is angry, I see no reason to be angry too. For only one should lose, not both. This is the game." End quote. Jennifer wrote about June in the same way. In one entry, after a recent fight had turned physical, she wrote, quote, "Who is really mad, Jay or me? Is Jay possessed by a demon? Am I? There must be a spirit that won't leave me alone. All my life it has been with me. I call it the beast. I am now thinking I should like to be rid of Jay forever. She is just a bag of misery. She doesn't cooperate with my beliefs. I cannot help myself. She thinks me so aloof. She doesn't realize that beneath my image, I also have a heart. I feel so forsaken. I always seem to lose. June has won all the battles. I always suffer with the knowledge that I have lost. It is not the material things I speak of. It is the mind. Her thoughts, her words, her wicked, beautiful words make her a winner. I don't forget the words. They haunt me. Her criticism haunts me. Her past haunts me. She is the ghost, and I am the mortal soul, the soul that someday must die. I feel as though I have to just put Jay in her grave. I have thrown her in, never to come up again, but her words will always pick a way to come back and haunt me. June is too much of a powerful force. End quote. Some of these diaries were found by the staff and thrown away, while others were put in their personal belongings. Meanwhile, the girls' lawyers were hard at work. They deferred the trial in the twins' best interest. The prosecution had strong evidence against them. They had written confessions within their diaries. There was no chance of the twins being found not guilty, but they had an idea. Perhaps they would be able to get the twins treatment in a mental hospital rather than a prison sentence. Michael Jones found a psychiatrist who specialized in working with young offenders. His name was Dr. William Spry. He met with June and Jennifer, read their diaries, asked for reports from the twins' teachers, their previous psychiatrist, educational psychologist, and other staff at Eastgate. June and Jennifer opened up to him about their problems, through the telephone, of course. Jennifer told Dr. Spry that she heard voices, saw visions, and had strong desires to kill June. June shared that she was extremely sensitive, could easily pick up on people's moods and emotions, and often had dreams and premonitions. She also expressed that she felt very withdrawn, although she thought that Jennifer was more withdrawn than her. She, too, had expressed her desire to kill Jennifer. She expressed that only one of them should have been born, and that life would have been smoother. Dr. Spry noted their psychopathic behaviors and their quote-unquote aggressive mutism. The girls' lawyers based their entire defense around this report. Dr. Spry would need to find a mental hospital that was willing to take the girls, and he settled on Broadmoor. It wasn't ideal because they didn't have a unit for adolescent girls. However, it was the only place that would take them. Dr. John Hamilton was Broadmoor's consultant psychiatrist, and he would serve as the psychiatric expert at the twins' trial. Dr. Spry and Dr. Hamilton told the girls that if everything went as they hoped at the trial, they would be going to Broadmoor for a few years. They described the hospital as having a village atmosphere, more freedom provided that they behave, therapists and nurses, hairdressers, gardens, and sports facilities. The girls began to fantasize about Broadmoor. June wrote about how she would be normal at Broadmoor. She wrote, quote, "When I get to the hospital, I won't be suffering. I'll be sitting with other people, enjoying the sun. I'll be movable and approachable and talkative. If I'm quiet one day, it will be because of my mood, not that I'm slowly deteriorating." End quote. The trial was finally set for May 27, 1982. The twins saw their trial as an opportunity for fame. They were the big arsonists of Haverford West. However, only their parents, Tim Thomas, and three or four reporters were present. They felt that this was a letdown. The clerk read out the 16 joint charges for burglary, theft, and arson. Both girls had their moment in court when they said the word guilty. When it was time for sentencing, the judge presented his findings. He found that their disorder was enough to warrant immediate detention for medical treatment. Due to the difficulty of their prognosis, he sentenced the girls to Broadmoor Hospital indefinitely. Vacancies would become available within the next 28 days, and in the meantime, they were to remain at Puckle Church. When the girls left the courtroom, there was no major drama from the reporters, which disappointed them. They were escorted back to Puckle Church. The guards didn't want to take any risks of fighting between the girls, so they were separated into their own rooms for the remainder of their time there. They were no longer made to join in on exercise and association time, and their food was brought to their rooms daily. In her diary, June wrote, quote, "The words kept going round in my mind, spinning in circles. Sick. Mental. Psychopathic. Imagine how I felt. Me, a mental psychopath? I had only heard about things like that in Alfred Hitchcock, or read about them in the papers. A dangerous, evil, ruthless criminal. Me. At last, my torment, my self-consciousness, my violence is known. I am labeled. Now I know my fate. June Allison Gibbons, aged just 19, going down in history as a psychopath." End quote. On June 21st, 1982, the girls arrived at Broadmoor. When they arrived, they wanted so badly to fit in. They acted normally at first, but it was just too big with too many people, and they withdrew again. Broadmoor had a system in place, much like snakes and ladders. There were different wards and houses, and there were about 20 or so rooms in each, and the patient would be placed in the lowest number room and would be moved up or down based on their behavior. The female wards were known as Lancaster Ward 1, 2, and 3, and York House 1, 2, and 3. Each of those was better than the last, with Lancaster 1 being the intensive care unit, reserved for the worst-behaved patients or the ones who needed the most rehabilitation. The walls were bare, the windows were barred, and only a mattress was in the room. York House 3 was for the best-behaved patients, or the ones who were almost out of the hospital. These rooms had a nice bed, desk, a rug, a locker for their personal possessions, and the patients in these rooms also had a day pass, which allowed them to move throughout the hospital freely. June and Jennifer had started out in York House 2, in separate but adjoining rooms. They were able to talk to each other through their windows. They were also allowed to write each other and visit each other during common hours. It wasn't long before Jennifer became enraged by her entrapment, and she attacked a nurse. She was transferred to the bottom room in Lancaster 1. Just 13 days later, June was transferred to Lancaster 1 because she had been found trying to strangle herself with a belt in her room. Jennifer skipped the system and took June's old spot in York House 2. The psychiatrist at Broadmoor thought it was best to keep the girls separated. If they behaved well and attempted to speak, they were rewarded with a visit with each other on Saturdays, and they were still allowed to write each other. Meanwhile, a journalist named Marjorie Wallace learned about the girls when she was working as a writer for London's Sunday Times. She reported on their trial and took an extreme interest in their case. She was so intrigued that she spoke with Aubrey and Gloria, who invited her to their home and allowed her to take the twins' diaries, manuscripts, poems, and drawings, really anything that she could get her hands on. All of it was just sitting in black bags in the girls' rooms, as they had recently been returned by the police. A few weeks later, one of Broadmoor's psychiatrists read the article she had written about the silent twins, and he contacted her and invited her to visit them. He thought that Marjorie may be able to encourage the girls to continue their creative writing. Marjorie began visiting them shortly after Jennifer was first transferred to Lancaster Ward 1, and she would continue her visits over the years, developing a friendship with June and Jennifer. In 1987, with the girls' permission, Marjorie Wallace published a book about them called The Silent Twins. As a part of my research, I read this book, and I would recommend reading it for yourselves as well. The book has journal entries from the girls, segments of their novels, poems, pictures, and drawings. It gives a really in-depth insight into June and Jennifer's minds, and it gives so many details into everything that had happened in the girls' lives right up to the point of the book being published. When the twins first met with Marjorie, they were separated, and they told her that they desperately wanted to be back together. However, the psychiatrist at Broadmoor felt that they really needed a long period of separation and treatment before they would be allowed to be together again. Because of this, the twins were rewarded in other ways. Good behavior allowed them more visits with each other, and they could put their name in to go to socials, discos, and bingo with the male ward. The girls really did have a lot of fun at these events, and they even developed some prison romances, but it wasn't enough. Together, they devised a plan. On May 27, 1983, exactly 1 year after their trial, Jennifer stood at the locked door between York House and Lancaster 2. She pulled the alarm, and when a nurse came after her, she attacked the nurse, reaching for her keys. The initial plan was to meet at the locked door between the two wards and attack at the same time so that June and Jennifer would both be moved to intensive care in Lancaster 1, or they would swap spots in the wards again like they had before. Either way, they were trying to manipulate the system. Unfortunately for Jennifer, June wasn't able to follow through. She had been caught before her part of the plan was complete. June remained in Lancaster 2 while Jennifer was sent to Lancaster 1. After this little stunt, the psychiatrist visited the girls and threatened to send one of them to Rampton Special Hospital if they didn't behave. His idea was to use the system against them so that the twins would retaliate against each other and not the hospital. The idea of a more serious separation had scared the twins into participating and behaving as they should. Eventually, the girls were both diagnosed with schizophrenia and were routinely administered injections of Dipixol, a tranquilizing medication. June later reported that this medication caused them to lose their shyness. She said that it gave them a hazy feeling in their mind and that the medication caused them to forget themselves and start speaking. Each year, a case conference would be held to discuss the girls' progress, whether they should remain separated, and their potential release from Broadmoor. For a long time, it was decided that another year was necessary. The girls really didn't understand this, and June later questioned this, saying, "Why? We were normal, we were talking, why did we have to stay another year?" Jennifer and June would spend the next 12 years of their life at Broadmoor. In the spring of 1992, the doctors at Broadmoor finally thought that the twins' behavior had improved sufficiently enough to allow them to continue rehabilitation in less secure conditions. Knowing that they would soon be released, the twins evaluated their twinship once more. The two felt the same way they always had. The only way to true freedom was for there to only be one. The twins became obsessed with death and talked about which one would die first, allowing the other to be free. In their teenage years, the twins often spoke about killing each other. Now, at age 29, they spoke of a sacrifice. June told Jennifer, "You're strong. If I die, you'll get over it fast. You're a fighter." Jennifer disagreed, saying, "Don't die before me. Please let me die first." These were actual conversations overheard by staff. Jennifer wrote in her diary on January 24, 1993, quote, "I have at long last conquered my fear of death, and now I am no longer a baby, but a woman. I can see. Oh yes, Lord, now I can see." End quote. In Marjorie's last visit with the girls on February 8, 1993, June, Jennifer, and Marjorie were having their normal conversation, joking and laughing with each other. Marjorie noticed that Jennifer was looking slim, and she asked if she had been eating okay. They both reassured Marjorie that they no longer had an eating disorder, and Jennifer told her that she would be fine as soon as she left Broadmoor. Then Marjorie watched June and Jennifer link fingers as if they had a secret pact. Jennifer then told Marjorie in a monotonous tone, "I'm going to die." Marjorie asked why she would think that, and she responded, "I just know. I just know." The girls were set to transfer to the lower security Caswell Clinic in Wales on March 9, 1993. It was their first step towards freedom. On March 7th, Jennifer told June that she wasn't really feeling well. On the 8th, Jennifer couldn't keep any food down. She felt weak and she was out of breath. She told June that she was dying and June took it as a joke. She joked back, saying, "Don't die on me yet, not before we leave Broadmoor." The next morning was March 9th, the day of their release. June and Jennifer got on a bus that would transfer them to Caswell Clinic. Jennifer said, "Oh, June, at long last we're out." She rested her head on June's shoulder and appeared to fall asleep. Her eyes were still a bit open and glazed over. June asked the nurses about it, but they said that she was probably just drowsy from the travel sickness pills they had given her. The bus arrived at Caswell at 1 p.m. They tried to wake Jennifer, but she was unresponsive. They carried her into the ward and alerted a doctor who took a blood sample. Her blood pressure seemed stable, so they didn't think the situation required emergency action. 2 hours later, Jennifer's heart rate and breathing had both increased rapidly. The results of the blood test came back, and they didn't look good. Jennifer was immediately taken to the Princess of Wales Hospital by ambulance. But at 6:15 p.m., Jennifer was pronounced dead. The official cause of Jennifer's death was labeled as acute myocarditis and inflammation of the heart. This condition is rarely fatal, so why did Jennifer die? The coroner found no evidence of drugs or poison in her system and found no evidence of foul play. Her death is truly a mystery. Was the acute myocarditis really the cause of her death? Could it be that she had been starving herself and her body shut down? Or was it the pact between the twins that one of them needed to die for the other to be free? Was this Jennifer fulfilling her promise? Somehow, she knew that she would be the first to die. Along with telling Marjorie that she was going to die and writing about accepting death in her diary, shortly before her death, Jennifer had written June a poem. It read, "That was our laughing. That too was our smiling. And now I am dead. And that too is your crying." Eerily enough, Jennifer had predicted her untimely death. A letter written to June in the early days of Broadmoor read, quote, "I know I'll die young and way before you. But it doesn't really matter. I only hope you will be happy. Love, Jenny." End quote. June believes that Jennifer gave up her life so she could be free. She also believes that the true condition she and Jennifer shared was folie à deux, or madness by two. She thinks that Jennifer was the one making her mentally ill and that they poisoned each other's minds. She believes that if she had grown up separated from Jennifer, she could have been normal. She believes that the reason she didn't talk is because Jennifer didn't want her to, and she wishes that she had just talked. In a documentary titled Silent Twins, Without My Shadow, Jennifer talks about her life and the impact that Jennifer's death has had on her. The interview takes place in March of 1994. 1 year after Jennifer's death. June is being released from Caswell Clinic and is truly free now. She said that she thought she would never get over Jennifer's death, but it's made her 10 times stronger to carry on for Jennifer's sake. She said, quote, "I feel that I'm living for her. It's what she would have wanted, for me to go on living for her. Every day I wake up and I say to myself, well, one more day for me, one more day for my sister as well. I live for her. What I see and do, she does as well. She's still with me. It's a big responsibility, but it's making me stronger. The more I think about her, the stronger I feel, the stronger I get, knowing that she's lying somewhere sleeping, and I'm still alive. I feel it's a privilege, really. End quote. She goes on to say, quote, I'm still a twin now, and that won't change, will it? She might not be here anymore, but I was born a twin, and I'll die a twin. That's the way it goes. End quote. June picked out the inscription for Jennifer's tombstone. It reads, We once were two. We two made one. We no more two. Through life be one. Rest in peace. After Jennifer's passing, Marjorie updated the book with a final chapter, and The Silent Twins was republished in 1994. In the updated version, it gives some insight to their remaining time at Broadmoor, talks about the pact between the twins, and Jennifer's death. In 2008, an epilogue was added, giving an update on June's life. As of 2008, she lives on her own in Wales, actively participates in family life, and is no longer on medication. She prefers to go by her middle name now, Allison. She feels that the name June just gave her too much bad luck. She no longer writes or even has a diary. She stated that she's really got no reason for it now that she can communicate. She still dreams of getting married someday and had even been on a few dates. There haven't been any updates on June Allison Gibbons since 2008. Today, in 2021, she's 58 years old, and it seems that she is successful at living a pretty private and normal life. A movie based on the twins' life recently wrapped up production. It's called Silent Twins and was written largely based on the events in Marjorie Wallace's book. It stars Letitia Wright and Tamara Lawrence as the twins. A release date has not been set. Marjorie Wallace described June and Jennifer as two human beings who loved and hated each other with such intensity that they could neither live together nor apart. It seems that the cost of June's freedom was Jennifer's life. That's all for today's episode. New episodes of Mystic and Murder will be posted every other Sunday. Tune in, follow, and subscribe on Spotify, Anchor, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, and more. You can find the podcast on Instagram and Twitter at Mystic and Murder, and you can search Mystic and Murder on Facebook. You can send in an email to mysticandmurder@gmail.com with suggestions, requests, and even personal spooky stories. If you like what you hear and you want to support the podcast, you can go to www.patreon.com/mysticandmurder. You can click support at anchor.fm/mysticandmurder, or you can make a donation at paypal.me/mysticandmurder. Thank you all so much for listening, and I hope you sleep tight. Remember, all things weird lurk at night.